Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. In his new book, The Loneliest Americans, J. Caspian Kang posits two Asian Americas, one populated by upper-middle-class people who have made rapid economic and educational strides, and another group of immigrants and refugees who are barely hanging on to the bottom of American society. The problem, for Kang, is that those empowered to speak for Asian Americans concentrate on their own class problems and not those of the working poor. Is there enough to unite these groups into a cohesive political unit? And no matter the answer, should anyone be trying to do so? That's coming up on Forum after this news. This is Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Demographic labels are a double-edged sword. On one side, a bigger group, Latinos, Asian Americans, gives heft to political concerns. On the other, some terms may become so big that the connections between the people gathered under the banner are too tenuous to hold them together for any practical purpose. This is a debate we've been having endlessly in the Latin world, and so I was almost refreshed to find J. Caspian Kang struggling with the affordances and restrictions of the term Asian American in his new book, The Loneliest Americans. Kang pushes and pulls on this theme through chapters on the Third World Liberation Front and other Asian student movements, the burning and looting of Korean stores during the 1992 LA riots, and an examination of the politically confusing misogyny of some online communities of Asian men. It's a wily, interesting, and intentionally provocative book. And here to fight with me and all of you out there, we have J. Caspian Kang. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Are we fighting?
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay.
All right.
I'm ready.
So Asian American as a term didn't always exist. It has this specific history that you trace. Can you tell us where it originated and how it was used?
Yeah. It started actually, you know, here in the Bay Area, not so far from where I'm sitting right now at a house on Hearst Avenue in Berkeley, and some Asian students at the time who were trying to get involved in all the movements that were happening, right? The anti-war movement was happening. Black Panthers were starting to become active in Oakland. There's the Chicano movement. There's a lot of, you know, it's the late 60s in Berkeley. And they found that there wasn't a place for them, right? That they would try different groups and some of them would actually say, hey, you know, like maybe you should start your own thing. And so they got together at this house, as legend goes, and they came up with the term Asian American, right? Because before it was like Oriental, or it was, you know, Japanese or Chinese. And that term is the one that we use today. But, you know, its origins are in a very specific, you know, sometimes radical conception of what these people would be. Like, in one of the books that I read, it was described of by the people, you know, one of the people who was back there at the time, it was described as like, basically everyone, you know, all the others, right? Everyone who doesn't fit. So, and the idea was to try and join those people together in some sort of political movement. Now, you know, if you ask people today what Asian American is, like, unless they have studied this, or unless they are, you know, a scholar in this, I don't think that that's what they would say.
Right. Yeah, it always had much more of that connotation of, you know, the Third World Liberation Front, you know, which was at SF State and is this sort of anti-colonial movement, but sort of inside the United States, right? I mean, it really had that flavor of 1960s radicalism.
Right. And that was, you know, that was ultimately where a lot of these early Asian Americans, and I'm not saying that as the people, but, you know, the people who had sort of classified themselves such politically, they did put a lot of their energy into, you know, the student movements at Cal and at SF State around trying to get an ethnic studies program going, which I guess is relevant today in California, right? As of last week, because of
that's right.
Bill to have all high school students take ethnic studies. Yeah.
At the same time, in the 1960s, you kind of draw this line of discontinuity in American history in 1965 with the passage of the Hart-Sellers Act. We actually have LBJ. We have a cut of Lyndon Johnson introducing this act. Let's hear that.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power.
So it's an amazing bill signing, right, LBJ? Playing down this act, you know, it won't add to our wealth. It won't affect the lives of millions. You're sort of like, it's almost like an inversion of the classic bill introduction. But you actually note that this bill did change America in this huge way.
Right. I mean, that clip is always so funny to me because I can't imagine, you know, signing something and just being, hey, listen, you know, nothing's going to happen. this is just nonsense that we're doing because we're trying to make some people happy. But yeah, no, he was wrong, you know, and, you know, I hate to say it, but the people at the time, you know, who were the opponents of the bill, who were warning about, like, you know, quote, floods of migrants coming from Asia, in all parts of the world that they didn't want people to come from, you know, they were right. You know, billions and millions of people did come because of the 1965 Immigration Act. And, you know,
tell us what that did. Just give us like kind of the basics on how this changed immigration, like kind of before and after.
So before 1965, you know, you have starting in 1880, you know, in the late 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? Before that, the Page Act, there's all sorts of restrictive laws on Asian immigration to the United States. And it was very, very hard to make it into the U.S. if you were Asian. And most people either came in through, you know, other means or they're like tiny little quotas starting in the middle of the 20th century that would allow in somewhere around 100 people a year, right, from each country. And, you know, it was so restrictive that, like, let's say that you were like a Chinese person who grew up in South America, which is, you know, not common, but definitely happened. And you tried to immigrate to the United States, you would not be counted from the country that you're coming from there. You would just be counted as Chinese. So it's totally racialized, right? There's no other logic to it. And what the 1965 Immigration Act did is that it removed those quotas and it opened up immigration for, you know, thousands more of people. Starting in the early 1970s. Oh, you lost me?
Lost you just for a second, but go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Starting in the early 1970s, you know, a ton of people started to come. And then what they did was they brought over their families because part of the 1965 Immigration Act also allowed for, you know, what is now called chain migration. And so you would have one person come over, they would stay here a while, and then they would bring over their families. And that's generally how, you know, so many Asian Americans are in the country today.
It's so, you know, you kind of call attention to the effects of this migration on the country, not only just sort of in terms of demographic composition, but on really on the social position of the Asian people who came before and after the act. Like, what's that sort of central move of the book?
I'm sorry, one more time?
Yeah, like that people who came before and people who came after kind of have a different social position in the United States.
Right. So the first is that there's just many, 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 many more people who came post 1965, right? So the people who came before 1965 are a small number of people. Does not mean they're not important, but, you know, like they have been sort of dwarfed by the post 1965 immigrants. But also the people who came who were here before had lived in the United States for generations, right? Like they had, they were either Japanese farm workers or they're, you know, people who could even trace their lineage back to the gold rush or the railroads. And, you know, because of that, they had experiences with America. Like they could see how America dealt with them in a way that informed their politics and the way that they looked at the world. And so you have, like, for example, in the people who started the Asian American term, like the and joined the Third World Liberation Front, you know, some of them had been interned, right? Like during World War II. So it's a radically different way of seeing what the country can do to you. Like it's a radically different way of seeing the sweep of history. It is a deeper connection to the idea of America and the understanding of some of its shortcomings. than people who just sort of arrive in the 1970s and then set up shop, and then you know, perhaps like in generations, their children will see all of this. But you know, that's not the population that we're talking about today. Like the population we're talking about today has extremely shallow roots in America.
And so you think because of that, they kind of can't grasp American oppression in the same way?
Well, I don't know if it's a question of grasping American oppression. I think that, you know, that they have a different understanding of what America is, right? Like they still tend to have more, you know, capitalist ideas about, and they still, I think, believe more in this sort of idea of the immigrant dream, right? Because they are immigrants and they are recent. But I do, and I think that as a result, you know, they tend to be a little less political, like more, and they tend to, you know, be much more assimilationist in some sorts of ways. Now, that's, you know, part of the book is distinguishing between that population and then recent immigrants who live in enclaves and sort of, you know, don't really have a connection to America. And, you know, for that, those people, like their politics are totally different. You know, they're mostly informed by their homelands, right? So they're much more interested. Even my parents, when I was growing up, they're much more interested in politics in Korea than here in the United States.
And what do you think their dream was for you here, or for themselves?
My parents?
Yeah.
Oh man, I don't know. I think that they wanted me and my sister to be, you know, successful. But I don't know what they. I don't think they knew what successful means. You know. I think they had very vague conceptions of what that could be, right? And so I think that there's this idea that like immigrants come over, they go to the cities, they want to move to the suburbs and have like a white picket fence and, you know, two cars, whatever the story is. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think my parents knew what a white picket fence was in 1979, you know? I don't think they knew what a suburb was in 1979, right? And so it takes time, but like, and then, you know, the conception of what success is totally formed by the community that you're in and the experiences that you have. And so you just have these very varied ideas. And, you know, for the only thing that you generally know, right, if you're an immigrant and you come here is that, you know, well, you need education, right? This country, you need education to do well. And so that's why people just pour everything into that. It's not some cultural thing where it's like education is important. It's that like, well, we don't know how else to succeed in America. That's the only thing that we know.
We're talking with J. Caspian Kang, staff writer for the New York Times opinion page and New York Times Magazine, about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. And we want to hear from you. How do you see assimilation playing out kind of in your own life? Do you feel assimilated? Do you feel like it happened to you? If you're the child of immigrants, what was their dream for you? And of course, do you have a bone to pick with J. Caspian Kang? Here's your chance. He claims he likes to debate. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with J. Caspian Kang, newish Berkeley resident, staff writer for the New York Times opinion page and New York Times Magazine. We're talking about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. So you wrote this book to provoke a kind of different kind of discussion than what you were seeing. What were you like writing against in the modern discourse?
Well, you know, I had been thinking about, I've been writing about sort of Asian American things for about 10 years, right? And I had written a series of articles about, you know, one of them was about some fraternity brothers at Baruch College in New York City, who were all from Queens. They're all from, you know, sort of immigrant enclaves. And they had done a fraternity hazing ritual that ended up with a kid who died. And then I wrote a piece about, you know, the Harvard affirmative action case. And in all of that reporting, you know, like I spent a lot of time in parts of Queens and Brooklyn that were heavily Asian and not particularly wealthy, right? Actually quite poor. And, you know, it occurred to me that during all this time that you know, there's such an imbalance of stories about and the way that we talk about Asian Americans towards people like myself, right? Who well-educated family came over, certainly struggled quite a bit at the beginning, but eventually hit a upwardly mobile track. And then, you know, their children go to college and then their children end up doing okay in the world. And that there needed to be some sort of intervention or else that we would not have any sort of coherent politics, right? Like even, you know, outside of kids in Flushing and in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, there's so many communities of Asian Americans in all over the country itself that have a completely different set of priorities, right? A different way of talking about themselves, a different way of identifying themselves. Most don't even call themselves Asian Americans unless like they're filling out a survey or filling out some sort of census information. And so, the book is meant to be an intervention that we should, you know, either expand the category, we should either refocus the category or we should just get rid of it altogether because like, you know, like what does it really mean? You know, South Asian people, for example, right? People from India, people from Pakistan, people from Bangladesh, sometimes they're Asian American, sometimes they're not. If you walked up to somebody on the street and you said, what is an Asian American? I was standing there, they would point to me, you know, or if I was standing there with some of my friends who are South Asian, I'd say, which one of us is Asian? I bet 90% of them would point to me, right? Now, that doesn't mean that that's right or wrong or whatever, but right, like, the it's just to prove that the label is just so amorphous and so contextualized and that, you know, it ultimately ends up being almost meaningless after a while.
So I'm curious, why didn't you write the book about those people, Asian Americans, who don't have money? Like, why not center the book there?
Well, you know, I am a firm believer in journalism, but I do not, and as such, I do not believe in this sort of idea of giving voice to the voiceless all the time, right? Like I was not trying to write a savage inequalities type of book, right? Because I assume, you know, I imagine that most people actually do instinctively know that there are poor Asians, right? Like, you know, like who delivers your food if you live in New York City, right? Like and in the Bay Area, right? Like when you go down to Chinatowns, right? If you drive down through parts of San Francisco, right? Like you see poor Asian people, right? And they're generally invisible. And so, you know, the book is not meant to be a validation that those people exist. I, in fact, think that type of thinking is quite corny, you know, like just being like, hey, you know, here I am presenting these stories to you. Like, I don't think that is a good way to go about it at all. You know, mm-hmm. I think that we should understand that we all know that this is true, you know? And the book is really addressed to, you know, people, it is meant to be a wake-up call for people like myself, right? And not just within the Asian American community, right? This is any community, I think, has these issues, right? I did an interview with a Black host, and he was talking about how those same having the struggles of people. That all of that is, you know, that's true in that community. I'm sure, Alexis, it's true in the Latin community as well, right?
Sure.
So I think that as an intervention, right, that is the purpose of the book, right? It is not a book of, hey, let's get everyone, you know, here are some stories of these people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of your key mentors in life was Noel Ignatieff, this right. radical organizer, scholar, you know, and in his books, you know, Race Traitor, How the Irish Became White, it's really about, you know, building this cross-racial class solidarity. But you seem to be arguing in this book for building cross-class racial solidarity. Is that kind of the intervention?
Right, yeah. Noel was you know, friend and mentor. He's my history professor when I was a freshman in college. And, you know, his idea was, you know, like, there must be some sort of way in which, like, you can build politics around the working class that will allow them to, you know, at the time when he was working in factories, it was, you know, 1950s, 1960s. You know, there was great segregation in both the unions there and also on the factory floors. And the idea was, like, can we see that our struggles are shared, right? And how do we see that our struggles are shared? And I think that right now what we have in America is that we have a lot of sort of, I would not use this term, but I think this is what he would say. It's like a lot of bourgeois identity politics, right? We have, like I said before, the concerns of upwardly mobile, upper middle class group of minorities who sort of come out and they say, this is what's important for our group, right? So it's like, is it like, who won an Oscar this year, right? Like, how many people of X group won an Oscar? Or, you know, for Asian Americans, it's like, why is Scarlett Johansson in all these movies playing Asian characters? Or it's like, I have all these microaggressions in the corporate workspace, right? That's sort of the face, the mainstream face of Asian American politics. I don't think that there's any pathway for solidarity in those types of concerns, because it, first of all, it takes out almost everybody who's poor, right? Which is much more people than people who are rich, right? That's just the structure of America. But also, I don't think that it's a particularly sympathetic way of going about politics, right? Like, I, as an Asian American who, you know, has some proximity to Hollywood, like, I don't care what movie Scarlett Johansson is in, you know, my parents don't care. You know, my sister doesn't care. I don't know many people who do care. And so, and yet the people who do care seem to be the sort of, you know, loudest voice in each of these groups. And so, is there a way to abandon that? Is there a way to sort of focus the politics around things that people do care about, right? Like people who are suffering, like people who have lost their homes, like people who are homeless, people who, these are all things that, you know, people can sort of get outside of themselves and put some political energy into. And since every one of our groups has, you know, some people who are suffering, right? People who are poor, then I think those are much more valuable ways of looking at solidarity than like trying to do this, you know, like identity thing where it's so much focused on people who have already sort of made it in America.
Yeah. Let's bring in Makila from Berkeley. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
So I'm calling because I'm also an East Coast transplant, and I grew up in a house where my parents really instilled in my sister and I that if we are as American as possible, we will fit in and succeed, right? And it was the whole, you know, myth of the melting pot sort of thing. You know, they were part of that first wave of immigrants coming to the States. And so we did it, right? Like, we didn't eat with our hands. We're Indian. And we, you know, and we spoke English at home exclusively. And my parents were constantly trying to push us to have an American accent. And, you know, we were relatively successful with that. I mean, they themselves were kind of poor growing up. And then I moved out here and I met sort of that next wave of Asians and discovered that I just didn't fit in. So, you know, the idea of trying to, you know, be a cohesive Asian American political base gets so complicated when you start to look at the different waves of immigrants that come to the States and the different lessons that we learn. Right. When I was growing up, you know, Mississippi Masala was like this big movie. And I happened to have a black boyfriend at the time and people would yell Mississippi Masala. And meanwhile, you know, at home, my parents were like, I don't think you should. Da-da-da-da. So, you know, it's just, there's like all this like inside the home, outside the home, within the community, outside the community. And there's so much discomfort that it, you know, everybody is so in it that it's really hard to kind of look beyond that and say, oh, what's really happening?
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of times also when you don't have success at work, there's this feeling for that first wave that, oh, what did I do wrong? You know, and then someone points out, well, maybe because they're racist. And you're like, what? No, but I'm American.
Yeah, that's happened to me.
Yeah. Makila, thank you so much for that. I mean, I think, Jay, I think she kind of like teed you up. I mean, this is like this is the exact complex of issues that you're trying to kind of like pull apart. Right.
Right. What a wonderful call. I mean, you know, I hope, you know, I don't mean to plug this just this way, but, you know, I have found that in the week that the book has been out, the most sort of heartfelt and the most and honestly, the most reactions I've gotten are from South Asian people, you know, who, which is interesting because the book generally focuses on East Asian people. And I think that it is, you know, I think that the way I grew up in a very similar way to Makila, it's, you know, my parents were basically, I grew up speaking Korean because my parents didn't speak much English. But then by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, it was just like English only, right? It was, we lived in North Carolina. So, you know, at the time it was not really a hotbed of Asian American people there. So, you know, like, and then you do sort of come across new people. Like I feel this, you know, in the book I write about this because I, you know, walking around Berkeley when I moved here about 2 years ago, and, you know, I was like, wow, there's so many Asian kids on campus, you know, and it was like, I'm 41 years old, you know, you have these different types of revelations all the time. And then you feel sort of embarrassed by it, right? Because you're just like, well, why wouldn't I know that this is true, right? And that's just part of just growing up as like as a minority in America, is that you sort of learn things at different paces and all the information isn't available to you. But, you know, to address the second part of it, that sort of chaos, right? That sort of confusion, that sort of like, there are no real connections, even not just between me, you know, like me and poor immigrants, or me and you know, South Asian people, or me and people from like you know, from you know, the Lao population, let's say, here in the East Bay, right? That we don't speak the common language, we don't have common foods, we don't have, you know, we don't have sort of, we have different class structures. Like that's all true, right? We have a chaos in Asian America. And my argument, you know, is basically that we need to we need to understand that this is true. We need to admit that this is true. We need to stop trying to build these sorts of identities around and say that we all are included in it, because we aren't, you know, like if any type of Asian American identity that you want to build is going to exclude 90% of Asian Americans. And is that really a good way to go about it? Like, should we keep trying? That's a, you know, it's a question that I bring up in the book.
Guess the one answer to that would be, though, right, that there is just, you know, economically, many Asian American immigrants have done well. Like, you know, look at even the 20th percentile. It's still right. Asian Americans are doing a lot better than quote unquote Hispanic people or Black people. And yet we also know that racism persists, just like, you know, Makila was saying on the call. And so it what's hard is this sort of identity almost has to be formed as a counterbalance to the sort of white culture kind of coming at you, right? I mean, that also creates the sort of these strange shapes to this identity, no?
Yes, I'm not a person, you know, I'm not a class reductionist, right? I think sometimes I get accused of being such, but I am not, you know, like I am not somebody who believes that all identity politics should be like, you know, struck down and banned by law or something like that, right? Like I understand that people identify themselves in groups, right? And that in America, in a large part, those groups are going to be racialized because that's the country that we live in, right? And so part of the book is grappling with this because, you know, I do think the term is so useless. I do think it's so exclusive. And yet I think it's so personal to people, right? Like it's how they identify with themselves, and part of their life's journey is trying to figure out if they fit in this group or not. And I don't begrudge anyone for that process. I went through it myself. You know, I think I went through it quite badly, actually, compared to some other people. So I can't even judge people who I think went through it badly. You know, like I went through it the worst of anybody, which is maybe why I, you know, wrote this book. But yeah, I do think that there, you know, my hope is that if we do look at class more, right, if we do look at different ways of immigration, if we do say, hey, these people came over in this era, and they came over from this country, and this is the reason why they came over. And these people came from the same country 50 years later, and they have from a completely different province, and they have a completely different set of politics. We can actually get a much more accurate appraisal of what Asian America is, right? Like we can actually get a much more specific type of politics if we decide to engage in the type of politics around Asian America. And right now, it's just so blanketed, you know, it's so all encompassing and it's so confusing that I just don't know, like, I just don't know where it goes at this point.
Yeah. We're talking with Jay Caspian Kang, staff writer for the New York Times opinion page and New York Times Magazine, about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have heritage in Asia, how do you feel about the term Asian American? Do you feel like it applies to you? Does it fit? As Jay just said, you know, as in your life journey, have you found that you actually fit into this group? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. Want to add Sydney from Oakland into our conversation. Welcome to the show, Sydney.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we sure can. Go ahead.
Great. I just wanted to say, Jay, I read the book. I really love it. It rang very, very true to me, and I've been a fierce advocate for the book among my friends and colleagues.
Thank you, Sydney. Are you, Sydney, are you Korean?
No, I'm Viet. I'm Viet and Laotian.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you for reading.
Yeah. And what were you going
to
say?
I just wanted to, you know, quickly give some background for myself. You know, I my parents came here in the 80s, 90s. Escaped the violence in Laos in the 60s, went to a refugee camp in Thailand, moved to France, and stayed there until the 80s. And so my childhood in America after that point was among all other Asians. You know, I grew up in the Bay Area. My high school was 80% Asian. My town is the most Asian city in America, currently. And so the things that you talk about, this sort of otherized or self-otherized identity of Asian America, that was never really present for me growing up. Like, I never really understood those things outside of the sort of weak cultural signifiers that you talk about in the book, drinking boba, listening to, you know, Vietnamese music from my parents, going to temple, that kind of thing. But it was never like a political identity. And so, you know, you talk about sometimes that you were never really racialized until you met, you know, like a Black person, you know, not in a flippant way, but, you know, the racial reality of America never came to you until you really faced it face to face in stark terms. And for me, the sort of projections, the forcedness of the Asian American identity as this internally inherent political subject, it's totally incoherent for me because I never had to face those racial realities growing up.
Wait, hey, Sydney, hang with us. We're going to have to go into the break, but hang with us. We're talking with Jay Caspian Kang, staff writer for the New York Times Opinion Page and New York Times Magazine, about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more Forum right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We've been talking with listener Sydney from Oakland, as well as with Jay Caspian Kang, staff writer for the New York Times Opinion Page and New York Times Magazine, about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. And Jay, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to something that Sydney said, which was about sort of how you became racialized as a small child, like how you came into kind of racial consciousness, I guess I would say.
Well, you know, I think that as a child, I had some understanding that I was not white, right? But it never crossed my mind because my parents were, as I said, so fully assimilationist. And there was this great contradiction that I think a lot of people will identify with if they grew up in immigrant households, where it's just like, okay, we speak Korean at home. My parents don't speak much English, right? But their message to me is like, none of this matters, you know, like you're just as American as everybody else. And, you know, you believe it because you're a kid, right? And, you know, this is not everybody grew up this way, right? But I certainly grew up this way. I think a lot of people will identify with this. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day where, you know, I remember that by when I was 6 or 7 years old, we moved to the suburbs for a little bit in Boston. And, one of my first real clear memories was standing at the bus circle and seeing the Metco bus come up, right? Metco was the busing program in Boston. And, seeing Black students get off the bus I remember it even right now, like, you know, some sort of Proustian moment, I guess, but like, it's flying back to me and it's, you know, like, I just remember thinking at that time, right, that maybe I am not like everyone else at this school, but I am also not those people, right? And that is just a profound experience, you know, like it first of all, it's like, well, I'm not either, right? So what side am I going to choose? Mm-hmm. And at the age of 6, you don't really think, you know, you're like, well, I don't know, right. I'm 6, you know, but the thought does happen and it forms, you know, for me at least, it formed basically everything that I thought, right? And it continued when we moved to North Carolina, where at the time there were almost no Asian families in our town, but there are a lot of Black families as well. And then there are a lot of white families. That sort of idea where you start to try and figure out where that is, right? I don't know. I think it's a process that all immigrants go through.
You know, do you ever feel jealous of people like Sydney who grew up in heavily Asian communities? I mean, we moved from like a super Mexican part of L.A. when I was a kid, a town called Sylmar, to like a totally white place. And I oftentimes wish we'd stayed. You know, I think it would have been culturally helpful for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the time. You know, one of the things that people, you know, sometimes accuse me of is being like self-hating, you know, and then they say, well, I grew up in an enclave around all Asian people. We had a wonderful time. And, you know, I don't have all these hangups that this guy has. And, you know, to them, I just say, yeah, that's probably true. You know, it's a strange thing to like make fun of someone about, you know, like, you know, oh, you're all messed up. And like, yeah, you know, I'm pretty messed up by all of this. I'm sorry, you know, try to write something about it, but you know, you don't have to be mean to me about it. Like, but yeah, you know, I think that the kids who grew up in those types of enclaves definitely have a different type of, I don't think they have a different conception of what Asian American is necessarily, but they certainly have a different, you know, I don't think many of them may be spared from, you know, a lot of the neurosis that those of us who grew up like me and you go through, you know.
Let's bring in Joseph from Sacramento. Hey, Joseph.
Hello, this is actually Joseph from the Bay Area, originally from San Jose.
Oh, hey. Okay. Joseph from San Jose. I apologize.
Filipino Americans, you know, that term is it interesting. We had more affinity with the Blacks and the Latinos coming up in San Jose in the 70s.
Right.
You know, I think because of our colonial relationship with Spain and the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my peers, we were all military brats. You know, our fathers immigrated to the U.S. via the U.S. Military service. Hmm. And it's interesting, in high school, you had the Asian club, and then we had our own club. We had the Filipino Students Association, and it confused everybody. They said, why are you not with the Chinese and the Japanese? Hmm. You know, and we would do this thing, we said, we're Pacific Islanders. You know, like we had no sense of geography. You know, and we were very, very chauvinistic about this idea of being Filipino,
right?
You know, and we didn't really connect with the other Asians, and I think a lot of it was a sort of this class distinction with some of the Filipinos versus the other Asians. Huh. You know, a lot of us came from very, you know, working class type situations, you know. I'd have to say that the U.S. military service was a blue collar organization in the 70s. You know, you didn't make a lot of money being a being being a being a military man. You
so, Joseph, as time went on, can I ask you how you've ended up identifying? Have you, over time, been like, all right, fine, I'm Asian American, or have you stuck, no, I'm Filipino American?
I think I'm pretty much still, you know, holding on to that Filipino American thing. But I will have to say, though, the current generations, they're a little bit more, you know, they tend to connect to that particular identity, but there's a cost to that. I would say the cost of that is when you're thrown into this Asian American box, there's some positives, but there's also some negatives. Like currently, you know, you have the whole Asian hate thing.
Yeah.
There was a time when Filipinos, they didn't touch us because I'm not trying to brag, but they knew that we were the Asians you didn't mess with. Okay. But then, you know, now it's like it seems like there's this mentality that people can harass Asians in general with impunity. But there was a time, you know, we tended to put it, you know, put it all on the line, man, and you know, we paid heavily for it. This sort of machismo thing that we inherited, maybe from the Spanish, or maybe it's just from our cultural heritage of like just easily being offended, and we see we saw how we paid for it. We paid for it, you know. I got friends who ended up in juvenile hall, in the system, in the penitentiary, just because we wanted to be, you know, badasses.
Well, thank you, Joseph, for that. Jay, I wanted to give you a chance. We've had some comments, too, of people asking, you know, how should you approach this current wave of anti-Asian violence?
Well, you know, I think that... I don't know. You know, I think that people organizing is great, you know, and I think that people trying to protect themselves is natural. Right. And I think that raising awareness is great. I mean all that sincerely. Right. I think that, you know, I think it's another example, though, where, you know, we need to talk about what actually is happening most of these places. Right. Like we need to talk about who the people are who are the victims of some of this violence. Right. So. And we shouldn't sort of bring it back into a broad Asian American mainstream politics. Like, so one of the examples that I write about, and I think the essay that I wrote for the New York Times Magazine, is that after the Georgia Spa murders, right, this horrible event, 2 days later, like if you go through the news, there's just testimonials of Asian American people like me, you know, talking about the time when somebody mistook me for a delivery driver or something like that, right? Or I feel bad because I changed my name, you know, I anglicized my name from like Hyungja to Jay, right? I didn't say any of this stuff, but, you know, this is a sort of temperature that was out there at the time. And, you know, what was erased was like all of the specific things that put those women in such a precarious place. And you can go all the way back to imperialism to talk about that, right? But you can also just specifically talk about the conditions of poverty and of sex work, all these different things that put those people in those places. Those things were there, right? But they're drowned out once again by the concerns of upwardly mobile, upper middle class, professional class of Asian Americans who, for some reason, you know, take every opportunity to turn every type of tragedy into something about them, right? Like, you know, just as well as I do, it's like half of this stuff ends up being about like a positioning within the media, right? Like, which is like the least important thing, you know, at that time. And so, I don't know. I think that we should do things like, you know, quote, raise awareness, whatever that term means, but we should raise awareness about the actual thing. You know, we shouldn't raise awareness about Asian America as an idea that's like translated by a bunch of cultural commenters, because it's like that's useless. It's almost disrespectful to the people who died. You know,
a couple of comments, not quite on this, but around this topic. Jackie writes, my observation with Caucasian friends of mine is the root of Asian racism. is that they view the various peoples that are encompassed as Asian as economic threats because many have been successful in our society. Of course, that's due to hard work and, in many cases, a good education, but these whites feel threatened. Another listener tweets, part of the reason I see a focus on those bourgeois concerns like microaggressions is that that's all I see other more visible minorities doing. I don't see any other examples or pathways to visibility and acceptance. You have a perspective as very much an outsider. I do wonder if in parts of California where there are significant populations of East Asians who don't grow up as outsiders, what that's going to look like or if it's going to look different. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think that the commenter is correct, right? That in a lot of ways, which is that it was something that we talked about before, which is that, like, if you look at racial discourse right now not in small spaces, but overall, like, mainstream type of racial discourse, it is about diversity and inclusion, right? It is about diversity in workplaces, right? Speaking outside of, like, the Black Lives Matter and the anti-police violence organizing, which is very, which obviously is a large part of this, but I'm talking about identity here, right? And Asian Americans, Latino Americans, it's all those types of questions. And so I don't begrudge people. I don't blame people who process their politics this way. I think the commenter is correct. Like, this is the model that we've been given. And so, what the book tries to say is, hey, what if we just didn't do this? Like, what if we didn't, like, what if we tried something else? What if we expanded political possibility? That's something I feel very passionately about. So
let's bring in Catherine from Woodside. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi. So I'm Chinese American. I'm an immigrant and I have children that are adopted. My daughter is biracial, African-American and white, and my son is African-American. So I haven't read Jay's book, but I intend to, and I read his article in the Times, and he talked about white adjacency with the Asian-American community. And I know for a fact, my children's elementary school, they're full of biracial children who are half Asian and half white, but there are very few Asian, half Asian and half African-American children. And I'm very interested in his comment about the racism that is inherent in the Asian community towards African-Americans.
Right.
I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Right. And I'm sure, as Catherine knows, it's not just African-Americans, Black people. It's also, it's intensified in a lot of ways when the people are biracial, when they are half Black and half Asian. So, this is true in Korea, right? Where the children of, generally GIs who were, like, this might have been a generation before, but, like, people who are born in Korea are half Black, they suffer a form of racism that I think would be shocking even to people here in America, and discrimination. And that does transfer over because, same people are here in America, right? Like, those people were raised in Korea. And so, in terms of I think that it is I think that it's something that needs to be, like, I don't think that it needs to be something that is only discussed, right? Like, because, like, that's the sort of tagline that happens right now, which is that we need to talk about anti-Blackness in the Asian American community. And I've never really understood what that means, like, just go home and talk to your parents and say, hey, like, don't do this, right? Like, I think that there are better possibilities to address that. And, one of them is to sort of say, like, what things do we all have in common? Like, what are our shared struggles, right? Like, how do we identify with one another? And that sort of work is just not done. Like, we almost assume that there are no commonalities, right? We almost assume that there are no pathways to solidarity and that the only thing that matters is for the person to stop saying racist things, right? Like, I don't know. I find that such a limiting way to think about it. But I do think that it is sort of the mainstream way to think about it right now. I just think it's bad. I think it's bad. That's all.
John from San Francisco, welcome to the call. We got lots of people running through them now. John from San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, John. My question is for Koreans who immigrated here, like, my parents immigrated here in 1956, and the whole assimilation process, was like what Akilah says, but the newer ones who came here after 1970s, I think, are causing sort of a problem of not assimilating, by not assimilating. And I just wanted to hear if he had any comments about that.
Well, I think I know what you're I don't think that not assimilating is a problem. I'll just say that first, right? I don't think that that's like a moral problem in any sort of way. But I do agree that if your parents came in 1956, I am sure that you were one of the only Korean people that you knew, because there weren't that many Korean people here in the country at the time. Like I said, most came post 1965. In terms of, you know, not assimilating, it's true. You know, like I have aunts who moved to the United States in the 1970s, right? They lived their entire lives in Koreatown and they barely speak English, right? They've been here, I don't know, how many years is that, like 50 years or something like that, right? Most of their lives have been spent here in the United States, and yet they do not pick up, you know, they're not functional English speakers in any sort of way. But I think that's even more reason why, you know, the category doesn't quite make sense, because I think it assumes, you know, like people like me or John who, you know, speak English, go about our lives in America, and have, you know, are racialized in a type of way, but still are participating in a sort of legible form of Americanism or Americanness, I guess. But yeah, I think for many, many, many people, especially recent immigrants, that's just not true. And I think that's, you know, even more reason why the label is incoherent.
Last question. You know, you ever daydream about what it would have been like if your family had moved back to Korea after they got educated here in the States?
Yeah. Yeah. I think about it a lot. You know, I think about it every time I watch a movie or Korean drama, or, you know, every time I go back to Korea and, you know, I see what it's like when my parents, you know, my parents grew up in a war zone. They're refugees from North Korea. You know, they showed me photos of what the river looked like that runs through Seoul when they were children. It was, you know, shacks by a river. You know, you go to Korea now, it's not that, you know? And yeah, I do think about it, but you know, there's never a sense of regret for me, right? Like, I, you know, there are many ways in which I think my upbringing has made me into like a, you know, like a person who is, you know, not particularly well in a lot of ways, but I wouldn't trade it for anything, you know. And it's one of the anxieties that I feel with my own child, where, you know, I wonder if she will go through all the things that I went through that sort of formed who I am, and in some ways, you know, made me maybe sometimes unpleasant to be around, but that's me, you know. And I, you know, like I wonder if she, growing up in here in the Bay Area with a lot of Asian people around her, you know, or even, you know, in a way in which like she will be far more privileged than I was when I was growing up, if she'll go through those things. And there's part of me that hopes that she does, but then there's also part of me that kind of understands that she won't.
Yeah. We've been talking with Jay Caspian Kang, staff writer for the New York Times opinion page and New York Times Magazine, about his new book, The Loneliest Americans. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.